Sure is. And David Cereda join us. We'll open up the phone lines in about a half hour or so. We'll be back with him on Coast to Coast AM. David, do you explore in The Voice the psychic area of spirituality?
Yeah, we do. In fact, we interviewed Deborah Katz, the author of the book You Are Psychic, but also the science of psychic experiences is very deeply explored. And, you know, we... One of the things that happens in meditation is that when you're on the path and you experience this samadhi, there are six levels of it, you get what are called, what the yogis call siddhis, which are powers. And I think a lot of psychics that are born with gifts are probably practiced meditation or prayer in a previous life, and they're kind of born with it. Mm-hmm. But what I like about what Deborah Katz talks about in her book is that you are psychic. She really teaches everybody how to get in touch with their own psychic abilities. In fact, I took her course here in Sedona, and the technique she taught, I mean, it really worked. I mean, I was really blown away at how the actual method that she taught, you really get verifiable results. But what happens on the spiritual path, like, you know, I've had the ability to see the invisible universe and hundreds of ghosts and invisible spiritual beings I've seen in full 3D. But that's just, you know, from the perspective of spirituality, that's not the goal. The psychic universe, the conscious universe, is verified scientifically in this film. We look at the Global Consciousness Project, you know, with director Roger Nelson. We see that the Earth itself is measuring earthquakes on these detectors, the random event generators, hours in advance of the earthquake. Even 9/11 was picked up hours in advance of the actual event, Princess Diana's funeral. We're seeing that the Earth itself, these spheres of consciousness are psychic. So when you enter these higher spheres of consciousness, those spheres are the intelligentsia of the universe. They're actually giving you access to their nervous system, if you will. And so it just happens consequentially. It's kind of like a surprise. You know, one person might get the ability to heal. Another person might have brilliant insights into music. Another person can see the invisible or hear the voices of the departed. But it's important not to get stuck on the psychic, because that's just a gift. It's like, here's some cookies, you know, God says, here's some fun stuff. Even Buddha, there are stories that where Robert Thurman says, you know, he would put his foot down and cause all of his disciples to see the invisible universe, and he would give them a tour of it, lift up his foot, and it all disappears again. So these are powers, but they're not to be, it's not the main focus. And I forgot to answer one of your questions, and the first one from when we were starting was about, you know, demons and the dark forces. You know, how do we fight them off? And essentially, the more we get out of the inner conflict, in fact, Jesus says in the Gospel of Philip, which was made famous by Dan Brown, when Jesus is kissing Mary Magdalene on the lips, and then he goes on to say, and for me, this is the real point. I think the kiss was just to get everybody's attention. He says, in this world, there is good and evil. It's good things are not good, and it's evil things not evil. He's not advocating evil. He's saying if you end this duality, this polarity matrix, you attain true peace. And when you enter this true peaceful state, the dark forces or the conflict energy has no power over you anymore, because you don't buy into it. You're not giving it your energy. You're attaining singularity. And the second thing I forgot to answer was, I was getting so swept away, you know, how Buddha says you go from the sixth to the seventh is that you come out of this super blissful state like I was in, and you come back to your total human, and you have to do something for humanity to gain the grace to enter the first phase of the permanent realization of
nirvana. That's the way to get the key, huh?
That's the way to get the key. So it's kind of like a lot of saints and a lot of people on the spiritual path, it's kind of a spontaneous thing. When you know you're one with everything, if you feel the world around you in the sphere of global consciousness, like you can feel your own foot, if you injure your foot, what do? You put a Band-Aid on it. For me, it was, I could feel at, you know, when I was, 19 years old, 20 years old, in that samadhi experience where I heard the sun, that the earth was hurting, and I decided to become a tree planter. And that's, you know, 1.3 million prostrations around, you know, into the ground and planting trees for 22 years.
Yeah, you made a major career change, didn't you?
It, when you have these experiences, one of my gurus from India that I studied under, he said all his work is to make sure you have one satori. The Japanese call it satori. The Hindus call it samadhi. The Buddhists call it bhanga or just absorption. And once you have one of those experiences, he says, I'm finished with you because you'll never be satisfied. You're always going to want more. And that's what happened to me. I had one experience, and it's like, okay, everything else can wait. I just want more of this. What do I have to do to get it? If I have to sit and meditate every day and do prayers, I will do it, whatever it takes, so that I can deepen my experience. And essentially, I battled depression as a teenager. You know, my brothers and I had to move away from our real mom and move to Canada with our dad and our real dad, and we cried our eyes out for years, and I was depressed for years. And it was only because of meditation on a regular basis that I got in touch with healing my heart and going into real states of bliss again. And I think for people who have never had like a bad life, they've never had an emotional, you know, scar, if they meditated every day, they would go into these states way easier than I did, for sure.
They've been lucky, I guess, huh?
Some people, you know, they've had the same parents, they've loved them since they were little children, and they have great careers and great lives. And I think it's so valuable to learn in your own tradition. I mean, you don't have to learn from me, you don't have to learn from anybody, but just go to your own religion. And deep inside of all the religions, I have found that these seven heavens and the ninth, the eighth to the ninth, exist. It's in Islam. You have Muhammad who ascended the seven heavens, and he desired to go into the higher ones, which they don't number, which there's only one or two more. And then in mystic Judaism, you have the seven heavens, the ascending heavens. In Christianity, you have all the way to the ninth, Dante Alighieri. Dante Alighieri, in all the religions I've explored, in all the manuscripts I've read, gives the best description, because he's a poet, of course he can do this, of what it's actually like to go through all nine of the spheres of consciousness. And I mean, it's just a must read, The Divine Comedy. It's a masterpiece.
David, let me ask you, let's concentrate on a moment for people who want to get to this level, but they have a difficult time. And you say meditation, and there's ways to do that. Mm-hmm. What about these demonic forces that try to prevent us from getting through?
Getting through to where?
To these other paths of enlightenment. I mean, there are what I think people or entities that block you.
Well, there's things that can happen in your life that can block you. Now, this is a good thing that you brought this up, because it's something we bring up in the movie. Every great saint had to purge themselves of the demonic. On the night of Buddha's nirvana, which, you know, the full enlightenment, when he sat under the Bodhi tree, he had the three evil Gandharvas try to tempt him for the last time. Jesus goes into the wilderness on his 40-day fast, and he meets Satan in person to tempt him. St. Teresa of Avila had to meet Satan three times. St. Francis's students had to purge demons, and sometimes Francis said he would come into their room and they would be stuck on the ceiling and by demons. And essentially what happens is, the closer you get to this light, the demonic will come and try to knock you out. It does not want you to become liberated. It wants you to stay stuck. And it tends to attack you more the closer you get to enlightenment than it does when you're far away from it. And that's why sometimes, you know, very, very pure children who are really full of light can get very strong demonic attacks. That's why physically, many of the saints who have been on the path have had severe physical austerities and challenges to their body, because the closer they get, the more they get attacked. And that is consistent. It doesn't matter where you look in religion, you are going to see that all of the great enlightened masters had to purge the demonic. And the question is, you know, what does it take? And the more you focus on the non-dual state, I mean, I've never spoken about this, but I have actually met, and it's hard to even believe this. It's one thing for me to have said on your show before that in 1994 I had, during the worst year of my life, Jesus Christ appeared to me in a blaze of light 1,000 times brighter than the sun. And it was more difficult to look at him than to be inside of the sixth heaven. I mean, that's how supreme his enlightenment is. And in my personal experience of Jesus is that he is the whole thing. He is God incarnate in the flesh. That's just my personal belief. But is I actually, years later, had to meet Satan, just like St. Teresa of Avila did. And, you know, I'm not claiming to be a saint yet. I'm still on my path. And I'm doing this film because while I've been on this path for 30 years, this is what I've experienced. I've interviewed a lot of people no one will have ever heard of who are not on the cast list, just ordinary people who have had profound spiritual experiences. And I just wanted to show that many, many people are having these experiences. But when I had to meet Satan, looking into Satan is like looking into, it was extremely bright. He was amazingly bright, but his light is gray. And when you look at it, it rips you into the conflict. It wants to fight you, and it wants you to get in touch with your conflict and fight it. And if you fight Satan, guaranteed he will kill you. I mean, it's a force, it's a field, but it's also in the embodiment of a person. And I was so shocked to see it. I thought, oh my God, have I done something wrong in my life?
Sure.
And I lowered my gaze and I said, you are disgusting. I won't even look at you and I definitely will not fight you. And I was tree planting, and all of a sudden, the Virgin Mary stood outside of my tent with her feet and she said, I just wanted you to know that he is real. The demonic is real. And Satan is essentially the first angel that went from singularity and took in the knowledge of good and evil, the forbidden knowledge. So it goes from a unified field to conflict, duality, good and evil. So Satan's light radiates conflict. It doesn't radiate love at all. There's no way that Satan can trick you into thinking he's an angel of light. Satan's light is pure conflict and war. It makes you want to go to war. It makes you think egotistically that you can take him, you can fight him. And when I looked at him, the conflict was so powerful. It reminded me of Star Wars, you know, in the Force, when Obi-Wan Kenobi is telling Luke, you know, don't get sucked into the conflict, you know, stay.
Right.
Stay in. It's just like that. You know, it's like Darth Vader. There's this field that is enormously huge and bright. And that is what that being does. It is the master of conflict, and it tries to keep everybody in the polarity matrix so that people are going to war and they're wasting all of their energy on conflict itself. And it doesn't want you to attain singularity.
Isn't it fascinating, David, how it exists, why it is there, and what it does to us?
It is. It's really fascinating. And what's more, my dad actually wrote a book in the 70s called Inner Voyage, where he actually demonstrated one of the reasons. This is really good that you brought this up, because I didn't even have this on my list. But he said one of the reasons a lot of meditators get frustrated is they hear these grandiose stories from their guru about, oh, how much bliss they're in. And they meditate, and they get a little bit of peace, but it's not that amazing. I mean, a little bit of bliss, and then they give up, and they go back to their life. What my dad found as a psychologist is that you have to purge the dark matter out of your soul. You have to purge the demonic, the dark matter, and get it out of you. That's what purgatory is all about in Catholicism. There's 9 levels of purgatory, and this is the place of purgation and purifying, and you can't get to real bliss, my dad says, until you look at your dark matter head on, look at the ugliest stuff inside of you, and face it and cleanse it out of you. And then the real bliss starts to come. And it's interesting because most of the meditation teachers from India and the Far East kind of obviate or go around, circumvent that whole thing. It's like, oh, let's not deal with that. Let's just meditate and chant Om, and then we're going to go into bliss. Well, it turns out that he's right, because if he demonstrates in his book what I'm saying, and that is the demonic. All of the great masters had to confront the demonic and purge themselves of it and free it. And that's a process. It's a process of seeing how we get how our ego likes to fight the other, how we like to egoify our image of God and say it's superior to the other religion and go to war with them or blow up all their statues or whatever. That is a conflict. That's the polarity matrix. That's where we waste all of our energy and our financial resources. What would happen is if we attain singularity as a civilization, we would no longer waste all of our spiritual energy on conflict, and we would attain what Roger Nelson has educated me on the Princeton Global Consciousness Project, Teilhard de Chardin, the Jesuit priest who foresaw another step in human evolution, that we were not finished yet, he says. This is really brilliant because I researched this, that we would attain a new sphere. When humanity becomes single and we conquer war, we'll be one collective thinking planet with the power to do anything imaginable with the collective mind. And, you know, on this show, Coast to Coast AM, Art Bell has demonstrated what people call the Art Bell effect, when you get millions of listeners to focus on, you know, bringing rain to Salmon Arm, British Columbia, and then rain came and put out the fires and healing Richard Hoagland. That's the power of a new sphere. Now, when we get to that level, we will be able to collectively ward off hurricanes and even a giant meteorite that may come and strike our planet in 30 or 40 years. We will have the power as a collective mind to do that. And one of the fascinating things about shows like yours that is so fantastic is this is a place where you could actually experiment with that because of the size.
Oh, yeah, and we've dabbled with that. Sometimes maybe it's worked too well, mm-hmm. with bizarre consequences.
Yeah, that's where it gets tricky because if you – and Art Bell has been really sensitive to this, and that is if you affect nature, like, for example, let's say everybody did try to ward off Hurricane Katrina, but inadvertently we slowed down the winds, and it got weaker, and it did. And I know a lot of people prayed for that. But then maybe instead of sweeping by New Orleans in a breeze of wind and dumping all the rain in the interior, it was so slow that it just dumped all its rain in New Orleans, and maybe we did something wrong. Like, I don't know. I'm not saying I know that we did that, but I do know a lot of people were praying for its strength to weaken. So we have to be careful what we do with the power of what Teilhard de Chardin called the new sphere. But that is an amazing principle, and when you see that scientists are verifying, for example, that these conscious fields exist. When Einstein discovered spooky action at a distance, when they did experiments that, you know, you would take a mother and a baby rabbit and you separate them by thousands of miles, my father told me about right. this experience, and you hook them up to EEGs and atomic clocks, you pinprick the mother feels it instantaneously. And how are they communicating instantaneously when talking on cell phones is only at the speed of light, which is much slower? And then Einstein, what they did is they separated particle-antiparticle pairs, like Alain Aspect in the 1990s separated an electron-anti-electron pair, and when he stimulated one's wave function, the other responded instantly. So what this proved to Einstein was that this wasn't just dead radio waves with voices. This was, these rabbits could communicate with each other. The fields are alive. They're alive. And they're verifiable. Verifiable.
Stay with us, David. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Indeed it is. David Cereda, our special guest this holiday season. We'll be back with David. We'll take a few of your calls, many more next hour on Coast to Coast AM. David, why, if someone is a little more enlightened, gets into that area, they seem to be more at peace, happier? How come?
Well, what happens is when you end the conflict on all seven levels of your inner chakras, you start to resonate with the natural harmony of the universe, and it feeds you not just a very, you know, stale kind of peace, a void peace. It's sometimes when I've meditated very deeply, it's like winds of this incredible, soothing, healing peace are blowing through my soul all day long. And it's really, really noticeable. I mean, these things are not subtle. And that's what happens. The more we learn You know, Buddha says, you know, right concentration, right meditation. Meditation is not just blanking out the mind, sitting there and just saying, okay, I'm going to get rid of my thoughts. It's about deepening our awareness. And the more pure the mind gets, the more it's able to perceive these great spheres of consciousness. And when it gets really deep, there is so much presence, real presence, that is so fulfilling, it extinguishes depression and suffering. And it gets to the point that it gets so profound that, and I've confirmed this with many Buddhist and Hindu scholars, that in the sixth and seventh samadhis, there's no perception of the body at all, which means if you torture it, it won't experience any suffering. There's a Gnostic gospel that was banned by Pope Leo the Great called the Acts of John. And in the Acts of John, I mean, here we are in the holiday season, upon Jesus' arrest, he's dancing in this circle with his disciples madly. They're the ones who are fearful and gloomy. And he's telling them, don't be afraid of the death of the body. This is nothing. And celebrate the moment of death. And he is graphically devastated on the cross. John cannot stand what the Romans are doing to him. And he goes into the cave and cries on the Mountain of Olives. And in the cave, during the moment of the crucifixion, Jesus appears as a cross of light in the cave. And he says, John, remember the dance. I'm not suffering any of the things they say of me. Jesus suffers emotionally for humanity, that this is how we treated the most supremely enlightened saint who came to the earth to teach peace, that we murdered him. But he's not physically suffering. And that is confirmed in all of the great mystic, understandings. And the Acts of John, I think it was burned by Pope Leo the Great, one of the first popes, because the church really wanted us to believe that he suffered for our sins. And he did, emotionally, I believe. But these states, I mean, Jesus was born, God realized. There is no sensation of the body if he doesn't want it to be there. And he teaches us to eventually do the same. He said, learn how to suffer so you shall not suffer. That's what he speaks of. In these expanded fields of consciousness also, consistent with Pythagoras and Dante also, the nine planets in the solar system are not bare. We are not alone in the universe. It is very clear in Dante's experiences and many others, including Buddha, that all of the planets are full of life, of beings that Pythagoras said have tenuous bodies of light that we don't perceive in our state of consciousness. And the reason we don't perceive them is because we waste all of our psychic spiritual energy on the conflict. So when we understand singularity and we end that, it's as if a vast reservoir of spiritual energy starts to emerge, and our auric field starts to, instead of being just a few feet beyond the body, it starts to expand way out into the cosmos and merges with these superluminal fields. And then we get real knowledge. I mean, why was Pythagoras so brilliant? Well, he's the father of trigonometry. He's the father of all modern music. He invented the intervallic system that led to writing down music and the birth of classical music. He taught others to have the experience of the music of the spheres, including Beethoven, when he went deaf, heard the music of the spheres. Boethius heard the music of the spheres, who wrote the Principles of Music. So it's in Einstein's expanded states of consciousness, he's understanding how the universe works. Einstein said he wanted to meet God just so he could know how the universe is working. And Robert Thurman, who, the great translator of the Tibetan manuscripts, and tells in the film that when Buddha finally reaches nirvana, he gets to meet the king of all the Hindu gods, Brahma, and he asks Brahma in this blaze of light, everybody says you're God, do you know how the universe works? And Thurman says, Brahma can't answer him. He says, actually, I don't know how it works. I mean, I'm God realized, but I'm actually not the whole thing. And even that knowledge is beyond Brahma. And Buddha is shocked because he goes, oh, I thought you were God. And this is where you get into the area of, okay, it is possible in physics that if the universe started from the smallest pea-sized dot, smaller than a subplanck length.
Which is what they say, but I have a tough time believing that, David.
Yeah, which is what they say. Well, if when you started to learn to see particles and fields or auras, that atoms have auras, that people have auras, that the planets have an aura, the solar system has an aura. This is what Gary Schwartz, whom you've interviewed on Coast to Coast, who also appears in the film, he talks about these higher and higher brains that they're detecting in the universe. When you start to see that God is both a particle and a field, that God has an aura, we don't get so tied up in the images of God or egoified images of God. We get more into that field presence, which I think is one of the reasons why the God of the Old Testament, or God in the Old Testament, said that you shall have no graven, which means serious images of the Lord thy God, because God knew that if we started egoifying our images of God, we would fight each other and go to war.
Let's take some calls here, David, okay?
Yeah.
People are lining up here for you. We'll go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yep, go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. I wanted to ask David if it's like I've been trying to learn how to meditate really hard, and I get to a certain point, and it's like I just hit a brick wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't get past it. It's like somebody built it, just like a building it right in front of me.
Right. And how long are you meditating for when you're practicing?
Well, I just, usually within about half hour, 45 minutes, I hit a wall.
Okay, everybody hits that. Every single person hits that. I've hit it a million times. It looks like a solid, hard, dead end. You get to this point where your body starts to hurt, and you just feel more and more pain. But what's amazing about pain and that dead, it looks like a dead wall in the beginning. It's really the barrier or membrane of your aura, not able to perceive that which is beyond it. And that's because the force field that's held together by the conflict is very thick. It's a very thick wall. And when you're hitting that wall, that is your own spherical force field. And it's been built up over, I mean, I don't want to say how long, depending on whether you believe in past lives or not, but it's there. And it dissolves very, very slowly. I mean, one of my meditation teachers, his name is Bhante Shibuya Sabudi, a Buddhist monk who's been meditating for 35, 40 years, 10 hours per day. And when you sit in his presence, sometimes I sit with him and I hit that wall and it just feels like, okay, this is kind of boring and I just feel pain. The pain, allow the pain to bring you into the present moment, because pain is miraculous in a way. I mean, Jesus said, recognize what is plain and in your sight, and then that which is hidden will reveal itself to you. This is in the Gospel of Thomas. So what is plain is that dead-end wall, that physical boundary that you're feeling. Just look at it and watch it, and slowly the pain in the body will force you to come into the present moment, because enlightenment in God is only happening right now. It's not happening in the past. It's not happening in the future. It's only right now. So that kind of dead, it looks very dull in the beginning. So you're very, this happens to everybody, and this, George, is why I was saying earlier, many people meditate for a while and they get a little bit of peace, and then they hit this dead end place and they think, okay, you know, I'm sitting for days and hours and nothing else is happening. You have to be amazingly patient. I mean, you think of a karate master who gets their black belt. You know, I've been doing this every day for 30 years, and sometimes I sit and, you know, nothing happens, nothing spectacular. You're just sitting. But very slowly, give yourself time and allow the pain in the body to bring you present into the presence. It will mature.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're up with David Sarita. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hi, I was just having a question regarding to your references to Christian figures.
Mm-hmm.
I find it fascinating, being that I was a former Catholic, but due to studying it in-depthly, there are a lot of historical errors, and one being that Virgin Mary was actually mistranslated as actually the word for woman, you know, things like that. And, you know, Satan being kind of a bastardization of the name Hostan. So I was just curious if when you made those references, were you speaking literal, or were you talking about, like, the houses represented, so to speak, you know, like in Kabbalism, you know, you have the house of Archangel Michael and Gabriel and all that stuff.
Well, when you talk about all the angels, each one of them corresponds to one of the nine levels. There are actually nine levels in the Arcane of Angels, which correspond to the different levels of enlightenment. But when we're talking about Satan, I'm speaking from the experience of many religions that this is the first being that took in the knowledge of good and evil. So his light or its light is conflict. It radiates pure conflict. And it has an enormous amount of power to destroy. As far as the divine feminine, that's something miraculously that I'm treating in this new film. If we go into mystic Judaism, we find that God, Yahweh, the name that's not supposed to be uttered, is the male aspect, and the Shekinah is the spirit of God that's the passive feminine aspect. In fact, Leonard Nimoy, Spock, has done a whole book on this. And in Christian mysticism, you have the Sophia of Christ, or the feminine aspect of God, and then you have the masculine aspect as actually God. When you go all the way down through the religions, in Krishna, all of the great teachers were in divine couple pairs. They were never alone. The feminine part kind of just got thrown out or ignored in a lot of these religions. Like Krishna, for Hare Krishna, is God incarnated in the flesh, but he has a wife named Radha. When you come into Buddhism, miraculously, this is very little known. A Buddha was married to Yasodhara when he was a young 23-year-old man, and they had a child. At the age of 29, Rahula was the name of their child. And when Buddha went into the forest to seek nirvana, he left a palace to go into the forest for 6 years to practice meditation every day. And as soon as she heard when he left, she was so devastated. She shaved her head. She wore the yellow robe. She only ate one meal per day and practiced meditation for 6 years. As soon as Buddha came out of the forest, the first thing he did, when he attained full nirvana, I mean the most supreme enlightenment, he wanted to see his wife. He wanted to see Yasodhara, who was his wife, Princess Yasodhara. And when he goes to see her, she falls at his feet and cries her eyes out and wipes his feet with her tears, just like Mary Magdalene did to Jesus, because of the overwhelming aura of love. And she becomes a nun, and she attains full nirvana. And very few people know this, so that Buddha was in love, but when they reach this stage where their spheres of consciousness are so expanded, the desire to touch and physical affection starts to go away. Even Saint Francis was mystically in love with Claire, Sister Claire. In fact, Sister Claire actually, desired to have dinner with Saint Francis, and he forbade it. I mean, he didn't want men and women mixing, the nuns and the male monks mixing because of sexuality. Well, eventually he accepts her offer. This is in the Little Flowers of Saint Francis. And he insists that they have dinner on the ground. And the sun is down, and they look into each other's eyes, and he starts to speak the most sweet words, and everybody from miles away saw the entire mountain ablaze with light, and they thought it was on fire. And all of the monks and nuns came running from even down in the villages, people came running, and all they found was Claire and Francis gazing into each other's eyes, and they never touched their food. And the whole mountain was in a corona of manifest light. When you go through all and in fact, the father of Tibetan Buddhism, Padmasambhava the Buddha, is with Yishi Shogyal. And Muhammad was married to Khadija, was his first wife, and then he took many wives. Shiva was with Uma. That's where Uma Thurman gets her name, Robert Thurman's daughter, and other consorts. So you always see these great masters in pairs. So why is it that Dan Brown took the revelation that Jesus was with Mary Magdalene as evidence to strip him of his divinity and say he was an ordinary but charismatic man? That this isn't true at all. They were both supremely enlightened masters, at the very least, at the very, very least. My opinion of Jesus is much higher than that, but nevertheless, what this shows is the divine couple pairs are in all the great religions of the world, and yet women have been disallowed in the Catholic Church to be friars. They're not allowed to speak in Islam. They're kind of like given they're really given the bad end of the stick. And I really think that the evidence supports in every major religion of the world that women are equal to men.
East of the Rockies, you're up. Go ahead. Hello.
Hi, David.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, I have a question. I was wondering, how do you feel about shamanism and the use of hallucinogenic plants in the Amazon? And as the previous caller said, that she hits a wall when meditating. Do you think that certain plants, compounds, chemicals might catapult you through that quicker than meditation? And do you think that when you're meditating, there might be some kind of correlation between these chemicals and possible chemicals released in your brain at the moment of ecstasy in your meditation?
Well, firstly, I'm against, personally, the use of all drugs or narcotics. And in fact, when I had my third meeting with Jesus, he showed me, and you can take this, you know, with a grain of salt if you want, but he showed me that when you take these hallucinogenic plants, you cast the gray light, and you do get high, you do get elevated consciousness, but you get the deficient light. The gray light is cast on you, and you start to get demons attracted to you. And most people I know who have done ayahuasca, which is, you know, probably what you're talking about in the Amazon, see massive demons, and they claim that the shaman will guide you to help purge you of your demons. Now, I don't know ultimately if you can reach enlightenment using plants. I highly doubt it. Even Carlos Castaneda said that plants were used in the beginning by shaman, and then they weed their students off of them so they can attain it naturally. I'm so satisfied with meditation. If you learn how to meditate correctly, you know, don't be in a hurry. Don't think that you're going to meditate for 2 years even. And you might have some amazing experiences in your first year. Sometimes you get beginner's luck because you don't have all these preconceived ideas, and you don't have all this knowledge and all these different terminologies bombarding your brain. You just sit there and you meditate, and oh my God, you know, eureka, you have this, you go into samadhi or satori. But you really don't need plants. These things, if you look at anybody who does a lot of marijuana, they have huge bags under their eyes, and they'll sit there and tell you that, oh, it doesn't do anything to you. But actually, you're putting resin, plastic, in your lungs. I mean, it's got to be damaging you.
All right. Stay with us, yeah. David. We're rapidly approaching the final hour right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie.